call it good morning. Compliments and welcome back. I was back in Pretoria the last 2 weeks trying to secure some 65 entry level magistrate vacancies out of a triple listing and about 2,000 firms. So I'm still trying to reconnect with the institution, having been in a completely different environment. Welcome, and I'm truly delighted to see all the bright and beautiful faces that were here last year, all in one
piece.
I am truly hopeful that we're starting the new year with a new vibe, a new spirit, a new attitude, obviously positive, you know, cooperative and everything else. But yes, today we've got a task before us, and I am not going to bore you with my own poor, you know, summary of what is before us. I'll leave it to the competent people to do so. Mine will just be that of a facility. So yeah, if you have any details to throw it, either throw in this direction, not this direction. That's rule number one. Alright, we do have essentially one central issue that we need to discuss and which is before us, and we can see what little time remains just to look at the program or the envisaged work of the subcommittee going forward. So I will not get into any other business at this stage except to go straight into the matter before us, which relates to, as you all know, a matter that is before the Constitutional Court and certain expectations that we are expected to fulfill in relation to our own role of reviewing the rules of the Assembly. And on that note, I'm just going to go straight ahead and hand over to the table staff to lead us on the matter before us, and then open it up for colleagues to guide me as to how best to proceed in response to the issue that's kind of been tabled before. Over to you, Marina.
Good day, everyone. Welcome back. Yes. I hope you don't have my level of enthusiasm for all the work we have to do this year. I hope you have more than I have, because you're going to need it. I must apologize firstly for the late distribution of this paper. That's entirely my fault. I told that Mr. Jeffrey that I suppose my workload is not an excuse at this point, but that is actually the reason. But we are trying to make a plan about that. As honourable members know, the Constitutional Court has ordered the Speaker to present present a report on the 14th of March to indicate what progress has been made in relation to accommodating or seeing that there are appropriate measures in the rules of the National Assembly to accommodate motions of no confidence. The document that I prepared will gives you a short background. What I did was Judge Davis, in his High Court judgment, sort of summarized the main points that he considered with four questions that he asked me and answered. Sorry about that. And what I've done then under the different points was that I just pulled some extracts from the judgment that related to that particular point. And I trust that members have had a chance to look at that. What I then proceeded to do, or what we proceeded to do, was to propose either rule adjustments or to say how these four aspects were addressed in the current rules, and how they are supposed to be addressed. Certain of the proposed rule adjustments have options that we give, and I think I'll just quickly take members through that. It's in a document that's called the discussion document for Subcommittee and Review of Assembly Rules, Jury Justice Proposed, the Speaker's Report to Constitutional Court, and it's page 3 that we're going to start on. And obviously, these rule adjustments must be considered in conjunction with the ruling of the High Court ruling, and also the order that was given by the court. The fact that this must be appropriate provision for no function such. Okay. In the first place, we need to make sure that members are able to move a motion of no confidence in terms of Section 102. Now, under the provision that we have in the rules at present, it can be done, because if you look at the current Rule 94, it says a member may propose a subject for discussion. This is under motion. This is touched on motions. It says a member may propose a subject for discussion or, and this is where the no confidence motion comes in, a draft resolution for approval as a resolution of this House. Now, we have a choice if we can use the rule like that, because it does make provision for that. I mean, these motions have been moved. What we are proposing to do is just to make it a little more specific and actually include constitutional motions as a separate provision. So we are proposing that we change that rule to just break it down into three and say a member may propose a subject for discussion, which is there at present. Now the new one we're proposing is a draft resolution to give effect to a constitutional provision. Okay, and then the third one, or adopt resolution for approval as a resolution of the House, which is the one that we have in the rule. So as far as Rule 94, that's for moving the motion. So that provision is then there. Any member may move a motion or adopt resolution that will give effect to a constitutional provision. That is the first thing we suggested. Okay, then the first thing we came across is that, I mean, the court found that a constitutional motion in terms of Rule 102, no confidence motion, I mean, there's no question that it must be entertained by the House. So, under our same question rule, that would have prevented motions of no confidence being done twice in a year, because it is the same in substance, basically. It has the same substance, as I said. Okay, the current rule says no draft resolution shall be moved in this House, which is the same in substance as a draft resolution which has been approved or rejected by it during the same session. Okay, and then what we are proposing to change it to is to say, keep the first part of the thing, saying that no draft resolution shall be moved, blah, 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 and then to add, unless it is a draft resolution giving effect to a constitutional provision, which is what we, the second, as we have it in the Rule 94 change that we suggested. So that will then exclude provisions that kick in as a result of the constitutional provision. Okay, now one of the things that we are proposing for motions that come before the House in terms of the constitution, things like dissolution of the House, removal of the president, removal of a judge, state of defense, there are a few of them. For those kinds of constitutional, where the House is required to take a decision in terms of a draft resolution with a particular majority or not, what we're proposing is that the Speaker gets certain sort of extra powers there. But, and we call them in that proposal, we call them constitutional motions. So we think it's important, just for the sake of, for clarity's sake, to identify the specific motions that would be considered constitutional motions in terms of which the Speaker will then have the power that we are proposing that he has. And it's for that reason that we propose that we identify them you'll see what they contain under them is basically what is said in the Constitution. It's basically a bit of a piece of what is in the Constitution already. But it's really for the sake of clarity and for the sake of a quick reference kind of thing. Ms. Kelly always talks about how it wasn't to have everything, you know, in the same book, and you know, everything at hand when you refer to it in the rule book. I'm not saying that the ones here are comprehensive, the ones that we have. I have, however, looked at the Constitution. I'm not a legal expert. I mean, our legal advisors will please tell me if I'm wrong. If there are other instances where draft resolutions are required, there are instances I know where there are lots of things where we're required to do things by the Constitution. But in most cases, it's a matter of reports coming to the House and those reports being considered and adopted. It's not a matter of a draft resolution being put to the House and the House having to adopt that draft resolution by a majority or not. So I think I've identified the cases where the draft resolution, or that's the first direct way which it comes to the House. In other words, it's not by way of a report or anything like that. It's a motion to the notice of and moved and then considered by the House. Okay, so I've identified there the ones that some of them I've mentioned, the dissolution of the National Assembly, Section 50, removal of the President. For dissolution of the Assembly, for example, I've only included the first part because the second part of that provision in the Constitution, that is where the President, this is can dissolve the House. If we haven't, you know, elected a new President within 30 days, so that's not relevant in this case. Motion of no confidence, Section 102, removal of a judge, Section 157, and then approval of a state of defense, Section 203. Okay. At the moment, in terms of motion, Speaker is allowed to, or Speaker has the power to amend notices and basically make some other decision as he or she deems fit. With that particular motion if it's not in order. In other words, if it doesn't comply with the rules and things. We had a practice for a while where I remember under Speaker Dinwala where her thing was that if a motion is out of order, then she would return it to the member and the member would be told and said, look, this is not in order because of this and this reason. You know, either there's uncommonly language or it proposes things that fall outside of the jurisdiction of the National Assembly or things like that. And then the member would have the opportunity to bring it back to correct that thing and bring it back to the House and by way of notice again. So that's what how she dealt with it. Not correcting the motion herself. In other words, she said that she didn't want to presume by correcting the notice herself. So that would be returned in writing forward to the member who gave the notice. So that is basically what the power the Speaker has at the moment with regard to motion. What we are proposing,
there are two options.
What we are proposing is that we basically have two proposals. The first is, the first one basically takes the program committee out of the equation, in the sense that when it comes to constitutional motions, because remember the court, in terms of this motion of no confidence, the judgment was not that whether this a motion of no confidence would happen in the House. It's not whether, it's when. And if you look at, and then there are two things to consider. Who decides this, who decides to win, and the matters of urgency. The fact that he has indicated that something like a motion of confidence against the President must be regarded with a sense of, you know, that itself attaches a sense of urgency to it. So what we are proposing in the first step is that the role of the Speaker then be expanded. Our current Rule 100 says, Speaker may amend notices, and that's one of that I've just explained to you. It says any notice of motion which offends against the practice of these rules may be amended or otherwise dealt with as the Speaker may decide. Okay, and that's the one that I've just explained to you. What we are now proposing is that we expand this rule. The current rule becomes sub-rule 1, and then we add, at the top of page 7, a draft resolution proposed in terms of Rule 94B. In other words, that's the draft resolution which gives effect to a constitutional provision, shall be scheduled for debate by the Speaker after consultation with the Leader of Government Business. In other words, it's not the sole operation, you will obviously consult. Within 7 days of its notice being placed on the order paper. In other words, someone gives notice of a motion of no confidence in terms of Rule 102, and the notice must appear within 48 hours, or sooner, if the Speaker decides. And then 7 days after that, the Speaker must schedule the debate. It doesn't mean that the debate is happening within 7 days, but it's at least it must be scheduled. And then we've added a rule which is also, the Speaker has the same kind of power for debates in terms, you know, debates on matters of public importance and matters of urgent public importance. So, and Speaker then also has, this is a repeat of a rule that we already have, the debate on a constitutional motion shall not exceed the time allocated for it by the Speaker after consultation with the Chief Whip of the Majority Party as chairperson of the Chief Whip's Forum. In other words, after consultation with the Chief Whip, the Speaker and the Chief Whip will consult, and the Speaker will say, this is the time that we are going to be allocating to this particular constitutional motion. 60 minutes, 90 minutes, whatever, and then obviously the parties will take their time proportions as they do usually from that. So those are the two additional things that we are proposing. So it's not all motions that Speaker will, it's only constitutional motions. The Speaker will have a power to schedule. And also after consultation with Leader of Government Business, because most of these constitutional provisions also involve the government in the majority of the so, particularly the government. So that's why Leader of Government Business will be involved. And then, as I said, there is a repeat of a provision that we already have under matters of public importance and urgent public importance, and under the time allocated for it. Okay, and then we have the other one that we have is now retaining the role of the National Assembly Program Committee, in other words, function as it does at present. Once again, we keep the first part of the one which says that notice, you know, Speaker may amend notices of motion which offend against the practice, etc. The second one that we are now proposing is that a draft resolution proposed in terms of Rule 94B shall be scheduled for debate by the Speaker if program committee fails to reach consensus on its scheduling within a reasonable time. So, because the court was talking about reasonable time, expeditiously, urgency, whatever, so we're saying that if the program committee does not reach consensus on scheduling a motion within a reasonable time, then Speaker will have an overriding kind of power. Then we come to number five, which the fifth part, which is rather, I've set out in the explanation there that the National Assembly Program Committee, since its inception around about 1999, has basically functioned on, in practice, on reaching agreement on issues and things were scheduled by agreement mostly. I cannot, in my time at the table, remember a time when we actually, Mr. Hundy, can you perhaps remember a time we had to vote on something, and then, not that I can remember, ever. So the understanding was that they would reach agreement on issues. Now, as everyone knows, that's sort of the sensation stopped at the end of last year, or that practice was in. Yeah, and it no longer, and what we are saying is that it appears as if it's no longer going to be possible going forward that we will reach agreement on all cases of scheduling of the business of the House. And the one thing that we must try and prevent is the one argument we can have is to say that things must go to the House. But if things become acrimonious between the majority party and the opposition to such an extent that, you know, everything gets blocked for political purposes, and everything then has to go to the House for decision, you are blocking the House, you know, by its own business. It's being blocked from, clogging instead of the business of the House, having to take decisions on its own business in the House. So basically, and there was also, it was the fact that that mechanism of voting that exists in the program committee was never used also indicates that, you know, maybe there's a reason that we should maybe just look at changing it. So what we are proposing is that we change the composition of the program committee to reflect the composition of the House. In other words, that we have proportional representation in the MEPC like we have in other committees. And we've given two options. What we've done is that we retain the office bearers who will be the Speaker, the Deputy Speaker and the House Chairperson, the Leader of Government Business or a designated representative. We have the two main chief whips, in other words, the chief of the majority party and chief of the opposition. And then, because the composition of parliament changes with every new parliament, we do not determine a specific number of members. In other words, the formula will always change. It will be proportional, but the number will always change. So, for example, with the Rules Committee, at the start of each new parliament, the Rules Committee's composition is decided by the Speaker, and then, you know, there's a certain number, and then the proportion is worked out. And this is what we're also proposing for the MAPC, that the Speaker, together with the Rules Committee, in concurrence with the Rules Committee, decides the number that the Program Committee will have. In other words, it will be in proportion to the size of the party. They'll have representation like they have, you know, in terms of the support they have in the House. That means that we have to do away with rules 1882 and 1883. The one says that the matrix proportional representation does not apply to the NAPC. Now, obviously, if we change it, we don't need that, we won't have that rule. And the other one, 188.2 and 188.3. And the other one just says that the whips of the opposition parties, they can sort of interchange and you know, the one can attend and the one of the other and stuff like that. So what we are just saying is that the membership of the committee is the membership. So if we're going to have specific decision-making powers and voting happening and things like that, I mean, we still have co-option and all the normal things that we have that apply to other committees. So, but what we're saying is that particular provision in Rule 188 is not necessary. Then we just add Rule 190A, which is a standard kind of provision to say that the Rules Committee will make its decision. It says, the Program Committee. A question before the Program Committee is decided when a quorum in terms of Rule 133 is present, and I will check the normal majority, and there's agreement among the majority of members present. That's the standard kind of provision that we have in the rules. We've given two options. The one, at the moment, the composition of the Program Committee is 26. So we've given two options. The first one is if all parties have at least one representative, because the ANC must have a majority, it will lead to a membership of 37, which is I think can be done if feasible if one has a committee that doesn't meet every week. But to have a meeting that meets every week and decide on the program every week and to have a quorum every week, it might be a problem for that. So what we are suggesting is that we might consider that we recommend the second option if you decide to change the membership, because in that case we have 23, but that means that you have the smaller parties, and I know they don't like that name, but we already have them in two classes, for questions and for member statements, members where they rotate. But what we are saying is that, as outlined there, the IDUDM FF Plus will have one representative, and then ACDP, UCDP, PAC, MFR, DARPA, and ACC will have one representative. So those are the smaller parties. And that comes to a total of 23, which is a bit more manageable in terms of size. So, yes, those are the rules and all the considerations. I know Mr. Jeffrey asked us to also look at KwaZulu-Natal. We only managed to get a couple of their rules this morning, so I haven't had a chance to study it properly. But Mr. Turkle spoke to the secretary on that side, if I'm not mistaken. And the way she explained it, but she said she's not sure whether they could use it, she must find out, is that when you have a provision in the rules which says that because the majority party is the majority in the House, when you need to take a decision, even if there's a quorum and you need to take a decision and there are not enough members of the majority party present, for example, the decision is deemed to be carried if the majority party is in favour of it because of the fact that it has the majority in the House. So I think that is the third option that Mr. Jeffrey said that we must just have a look at and put to the committee for possible consideration. So in other words, that would mean that we could retain the current composition of the NA, of the NAPC, but if there were a dispute in the committee and they wanted to go to a decision, as I understand it, then even if the majority party is in the minority in that committee, if they are in favour of the question, it would be deemed to be carried because they are in the majority in the House.
This was from the time when the IFP were in the majority, so possibly Dr. Ambrosini could, I suspect he was the one behind that provision. All right. I'm going to open the platform for engagement. This was an attempt by the table staff to give it an initial go. It's not the Bible. And if there are other ideas to talk around, let's feel free to do so. Now, what I also want to indicate is that ideally when we go to the full rules committee, we should go there with the confidence that our different political parties support whatever ideas that we'll be bringing there. I'm not sure if we'll have a second bite at the subcom before that group committee, but after parties have had some opportunity to engage with their caucuses and toss around these ideas with their fuller caucuses so that they themselves can have full mandate politically into the rules committee, because once in the rules committee, that decision then becomes the institutional position. But having said so, and maybe in your comments you can also reflect on that as well. JJ, I saw your hand first, and then I'll come to Ms. Ambrosini and then we'll proceed.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, my understanding of what we're doing is looking at options, looking at proposals that can then go to parties for agreement. And I think what we need to be doing is, I mean, I think the KZN example is a good one. We're looking for methods of dealing with this issue that would apply across the board. So in KZN, that's a rule that came from the IFP when it was the majority party. I'm not sure what the situation is in the Western Cape legislature, but I know that there were a number of complaints from my party regarding programming issues. So it's something that we need to look at, something that is fair to everybody, but accepts democratic rights. But then having looked at that, so these are just sort of some initial individual comments more. My worry with the wording of a draft resolution to give effect to a constitutional provision, I think it's quite unclear. The Constitution is a big document. There's rights. You could have a resolution wanting people to have water as giving effect to a constitutional provision. We will have to look at, I think, a different wording to describe that. I don't think that is the appropriate one. What is there is what is listed under the proposed Rule 98A. But maybe we should have a wording for it and then list the sections of the Constitution it refers to. And I don't think we should put the Constitution in our rules. I think it's not good practice in the Constitution. If we want to make it easier to read, then let's refer specifically to those sections of the Constitution. What, you know, if you put it into the rules, then when the Constitution, if the Constitution is amended, then things like that happen. Now, I think the other thing that I'm not clear about is that, you know, the Western Cape judgment, Judge Davis's judgment was that the right to have motions of no confidence debated. But now, is that right unfettered? We've got 11 parties, or how many parties have we got now? How many? 13. Can each party have to bring a motion of no confidence, and each year? Can we discuss motions of, do we have to discuss motions of no confidence whenever a party wants to? Where do the motions rate on precedent? Surely the motion of no confidence brought by the leader of the opposition would have more precedence than a motion of no confidence brought by a one-person party, particularly if that motion of no confidence by the one-person party is the 12th motion of no confidence debated that year. But, you know, the issues of precedence as far as the program. Obviously, the first one, if it's brought by the leader of the largest party, would have higher precedence as far as bills and legislation. But, you know, where do you draw the line? So I think those are all issues that have to be examined, because I don't think one can, and I don't know if even colleagues from the opposition would agree, that there can be, surely there can't be an absolute right to have a motion of no confidence debated whenever, because the House could spend its whole time debating motions of no confidence. So, I mean, maybe that's something that the Constitutional Court would look at, but I think there's also that question. You know, the rule, because, yeah, and that's probably quite fundamental. The other thing is with the programming committee, I think it would be a given that the majority party should, and I think it's what happens in all parliaments, the majority party, particularly if it has a majority in the House, should determine the program of the National Assembly. You know, we get elected to do things, to pass legislation. You can't have a situation, I think, where, I mean, look, there's bills that the opposition parties don't agree with, that they prevent the scheduling of those bills. Those bills should be scheduled, they should be voted. There are various mechanisms, which Dr. Ambrosini knows well, where you can delay
voting on a bill. But a opposition
party should not be able to stop a bill being scheduled for debate. They may, as I said, employ other delaying tactics. That's standard practice. So it's the one is to, I mean, the proposals are basically to alter the composition of the programming committee to give the majority party a majority, whoever they are, and I think that is correct. But you want to avoid a situation where officials, every member of parliament comes from a party, but you want to avoid a situation where officials of parliament, the Speaker, the Deputy Speaker, and even the House Chairperson are forced to vote on party lines. You know, the one option that Ms. Sivano has raised is increasing the size. The other would be you know, the majority party, or the chief whip of the majority party, determines the program, and the programming committee becomes a consultative forum, where it's an after consultation with the programming committee. In effect, that's sort of similar to what was happening in KZN in the time of the IFP. So I'm just saying those are all issues to look at. But I think the issue of the motions of no confidence, I mean, there are those rules relating, you know, that you don't want a situation where a majority party can unnecessarily delay the scheduling of a motion of no confidence. But you, as I said, those questions of how often you know, is right to your emotion of no confidence completely unfettered? Could we have one every week? Is something that I think we need to look at, and the court may need to look at as well. So I'm just raising those as options, because I think it becomes, I think there's a twofold question: the right to debate emotion, a general right, which I would, as I said, think that whether it's completely unfettered and we can deal with it every day. And then it's the question of when are they scheduled.
Right. I'm going to recognize some number of feedback, but I just wanted to indicate that I think my understanding of the spirit of this engagement is that our point of departure is that we want to be full expression to the letter and the spirit of the Constitution. How to do it is more a question of modalities that we try to tackle, so that we set the proper tone for the engagement. So the Constitution provides for motions to be moved in this regard. Our sure that within proper context, those powers, those rights can effectively be exercised. I hope that the ultimate outcome would be one that is consensual, that pulls us together as an institution. Because we're not different parties. We are different parties, but ultimately we are one parliament. And there's no other way to function other than as a single entity called National Assembly, and I think that should underpin the approach that we take in the issue. Programming on the one side, allowing for the expression of this powerful right under the Constitution on the other. Honorable Lambertini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said, the point of the departure is to give full effect to the Constitution and the ruling of the of the court. I think the point of arrival should be that of doing so before lunch. So let's try to
get lunch again.
Actually, I wanted to indicate that my target is that we are out of here by 12 o'clock, but that depends entirely
and
on
indeed
the corporation.
That's a meritorious and noble target, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to. Okay, point one. How often and by whom? There is a right. I agree with Mr. Jeffrey, it is inconceivable that everyone can stand up every day and have emotional confidence. It's not done in any parliament. That right is satisfied by emotional no confidence having been held. Therefore, the substantive emotional rule, to a certain extent, must apply. If we had a vote a debate yesterday, we cannot have tomorrow again tomorrow. It's the same thing. We've done it. So how do we deal with these two? We need to have some objective criteria. I mean, ideally one would want to have a situation in which we write whenever there is a substantive reason that it can be held again. But I mean, who is to judge? When there is a crisis, then it can be held again. Who is to judge? Surely you don't want the president himself or the majority party itself to judge whether it's a crisis which challenges the legitimacy of the president. Objective parameters. Whatever we do is going to be, to a certain extent, arbitrary. It's like giving a driving license for 16 years old or 18 year old people. I mean, why not the day before or after? My suggestion and what I would feel comfortable with is the following. A vote of no confidence can only be held once every 6 months, unless its urgency is attested to by one third of the members. So, if there is one third of the members who, a week after a vote on no confidence, want to have another vote on the confidence because it just emerged that the president is something unspeakable. Then, you know, right or wrong, one third of the members in terms of the, I don't want to know, the judgment of the Constitutional Court, multi-party democracy, you got here then. So that would be my practical suggestion, and I feel comfortable. Once every 6 months, unless one third of the members attest to the airing. Point one. Point two, which has not been addressed but must be addressed. We have this comparative experience from some of the cases, but the vote of no confidence was born in Europe. It is the feature of British parliamentary democracy. It is in all the constitution of the 1800s, which arose out of the Great Wave of Revolution of 1848. And what you see there, time and again, is that the appointment of the government is done by secret ballot, as it is in our constitution. We elect the president by secret ballot, and that's explicitly indicated. And they've drawn the consequence, which I submit to you we must also draw, that because the president is elected by secret ballot, a fiduciary relationship is established by secret ballot, so does the vote of no confidence must be voted by secret ballot. It is almost necessary. We are free. We express our freedom of conscience. When we put him or her in office, we should have the same freedom of conscience in deciding whether we should keep him or her in office. So that's the point that at least from my side, or from my party, is a very, very important one. Then the third issue, who schedules what? We are in the process of democratic growth. 94, things were difficult. We need to grow democracy. Mr. Jeffrey has tried to be correctly. Mr. Jeffrey has tried to meet correctly the ruling for Natal, which says if the majority wants it, the majority gets it. But the fact that there were different times and we're all growing. No, we are all growing democratically. We are not what we were in 94. And we should
know you're not there.
Some of us are grown. Some haven't had the privilege to. Now, let's look at the rules as they stand and see whether we are not trying to kill a fly with a bazooka. The rule as they stand gives a special from... Bazooka is a modern tool of persuasion of people who don't like to agree with others. And who has more bazooka usually seems to be right. Now, as the rule stands, there is a programming committee which is a competition which does not reflect the majoritarian principle. The NC is not in majority. However, in terms of the rule, that committee votes by majority. The only departure from the rules that the committee votes by majority is...
Which committee are we referring to?
The programming committee.
Oh, all right.
The programming committee must vote by majority in terms of the rules. A convention has developed that it doesn't do so. The convention is not binding. Because in terms of Rule 4, no convention can be developed which detracts from what the rules say. So the impact developed because they wanted to follow a non-binding convention. My suggestion is to do the following. Let's acknowledge the existence of the convention as a non-binding convention. Let's change the composition to make sure that it is by majority, that the majority is the majority. So with the 30 plus members that is in the first option, obviously from the IP viewpoint, I would object to the IP not having some representative. But then let's continue the convention run that the program committee votes by consensus and with the same composition, which means that the ANC will call in these numbers, will call in the full complement only there when it needs to overcome the minorities, overcome the opposition, because there is a crisis. Because in the ordinary course of business, as you say, went on for 18 years, the system worked well. It proved to be faulty only when there was a crisis. So let's correct the composition where the problem was. The problem was not on the consensus, because the consensus, there is no consensus.
Actually, my inclination is to say that all committees of parliament generally operate on a consensual basis unless there is something.
Yeah, but not in terms of the rules. The decision
no, I'm just talking in terms of facts.
But the problem with the programming committee is that the other position, unless by majority, can't operate because there is a rule that alters its composition and does not give the ANC the majority. And that is where the problem is. So we fix that rule, we give the same composition to the programming committee as any other programming committee, then when the ANC needs the vote, we'll send its people in. When it doesn't need the vote, as it does in other committees, or two or three people, very, very often the ANC is outnumbered by the opposition. So that would be my humble suggestion. And just to finalize this, because I think it's important that we do not create a rule where where we assume that all the ANC wants to vote in one way, or all the IC or the DA wants to vote in a different way. We need to move as part of the democratic process, where there may be a situation in which a member of the IFP votes with the ANC against his party colleagues, or vice versa. That's what democracy is. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank the table staff for the preparation of these documents. I think they've done a lot of work and it must be appreciated. I just want to concentrate on the one point, and that is the court determined that a member of parliament has the right to call for a motion of no confidence debate. That is all in agreement. Now, if we're going to, and I agree, you know, this unfettered right can be a problem, but it's never been a problem before. Now, if we now put in our rules something that limits the right given by the Constitution, are we then not unconstitutional? This is a question I'm asking. I don't know what the answer is, because you can't limit the provisions of the Constitution by putting it into a rule of parliament.
Except you must remember what the actual directive for the Constitutional Court was saying, or at least the speaker, that he must provide a progress report on how we have, in our rules, provided for members to be able to.
That does not include limiting the right.
I'm not necessarily saying.
No, I'm saying that my.
I'm just saying giving expression could mean many things in terms of the modalities of it.
But
I think the principle really that you're saying, which I seem to understand should be the point of departure, is that the operative idea is not to limit the rights to the country, is to give expression to the rights in a structured way, because otherwise an institution has to have some kind of structure in its operations, otherwise it becomes an amorphous thing that just doesn't have direction in how it does this. That's how I understand the context in which we plan to do everything.
But then we
in that spirit, then, let's come with concrete suggestions as to how best to give structure to the full expression.
Then we must limit the room. We must retain the rule. We shall admit that the same question rule, and not expand it to the constitutional. Because what we're suggesting is
In the one that says you may not move emotion on the same question as the same question.
Yeah.
So you say essentially let's retain that and that.
If that rule is there, then you
that
can't.
That takes care of the whole matter. All right? Is there any... Well, you're still on the platform. So
now that's the one I need to do.
All right. Okay. Marina, you want to make a quick suggestion before I get to the next member?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to say that the legal argument we were proposing the change to the program committee composition was not as a result directly of making provision for constitutional provision, but it's just that, you know, the way in which things were working and the way how we see things in the way forward and how, you know, opinions expressed by parties, by courts, by media, by everyone, the misunderstanding of
I thought you were raising a point of exclusion to the court. I'm still after the round. Give you an opportunity to respond to all the issues.
I just wanted to say something in the judgment as well, which might clarify something. It says if the consensus formula does apply to the program committee, then that position appears still to be incompatible with Section 102 of the Constitution. If the consensus could mean a subversion of the rights of the minority, if voting takes place in the program committee, it might also be incompatible with Section 102 of the Constitution. Because if one party or two parties seek to have emotional low confidence but not the balance, this may pose a problem for the exercise by the minority party of exception 103 right. And that's going to come to the threshold of things. We're going to be talking here about one party or two parties. That could be common enemies.
That's fine. We'll unpack this issue in the next round of engagement. For now, we just want to open up the floor and the platform for people to nourish this engagement with all sorts of fascinating ideas. Yes, Ms. Kevin?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. And just first of all, also my thanks to the COVID staff for the preparation of the document. I think, first of all, I think it's important that we just know that there are maybe other constitutional provisions that also need to be listed. And I must say, I think we can look at the detail of how this motion is formulated so that it doesn't only stop at constitutional provisions, because there are others. And I think it's a good point of departure, because it is sort of lifting in our own minds also the resolution that the National Assembly is in terms of the Constitution and title to that. And I just wanted to mention, in passing, I just noticed that section 52.4 speaks about the removal of the speaker in the debate. Now, we have no intention to do that, but I'm just saying that it's also something that should probably also be incorporated. I would appreciate it if we ask also all the legal people at Parliament if they can help, so that we can really compile a comprehensive list of resolutions that the National Assembly can take to that point of the removal of the system, so that we understand what the role and the responsibility and the powers of the National Assembly to have a comprehensive list. So first of all, thanks for that, and then I would like to address myself to the following evidence. Honourable Sini has already referred to some. If we look at the issue of how often a no confidence, bearing in mind that it is a right in terms of Section 102, we should also not make it a frivolous event. It should be quite a heavy weight that is attached to that. And I would, at this stage, step up with your position, only just devote my attention to the issues of the presence. I'm not going to speak about the judges, because I think we will have to differentiate between how we deal with 102 in the House and the other issues, because they are different. First of all, I do not have a problem with the suggestion that it is a substantive motion. However, I want to suggest that we should certainly not allow it only to take place once a year. And the reason for that is, if you can limit it to no more than twice a year, except and that is where I like the suggestion made, the proposal made on the conference. Unless this urgency is attested to by a threshold. Now, we can argue about what that threshold should be. And I hear what Marina has said about what the court says. I think what we need to understand is, you read the entire section of the Constitution. Parliament is based on proportionality. And if a too small threshold is turning this into a frivolous event, it's also not going to be good for the democracy. Because then it is a serious matter and it should be treated as such. And so I would suggest that we consider something like 6 months, not more than that. Alternatively, we could consider something that is meaningful to ensure that there is adequate scrutiny, because the accountability to the national assembly of the head of the executive is really one of those, one of the primary balances of power that is enshrined in the Constitution. And therefore, it is important to, on occasion, have such debates, say, where are we in terms of the existence of the country? So I think we will have to look at that. What is interesting is we must look at what the situation is in Portugal, where they have moved the motion of no confidence in the mayor, and that there was a time limitation, that no further motion of no confidence could be moved in 3 months, or something like that. So I'm not necessarily stuck on 6 months, I'm just saying that it doesn't become frivolous and it can happen any time. So, and then we should give consideration to the issue of the threshold. I really believe that is important. If it is beyond the number
the time limit, I think it's the timing, I think when that program is
I've decided to be generous and not be restricted by technology.
Thank you so much, Jefferson, because otherwise the Honourable JJ might have dropped it.
Yeah, mine dropped as well.
Contained in section, well, in actually in the schedule to the constitution of how the president votes, and that is why people done it. And certainly, if we then want to have a motion of no confidence, it should also be based on the same principle. Then, group schedules one. I would like to suggest that, yes, we must look at the composition and the role and the determination of the schedule of Parliament by the programming committee. That I just want to talk for now. I just believe that we could in fact circumvent that if we take some of the examples contained in the comparative analysis, where they say if a motion is tabled, this is what happens, it appears on the order paper, and then it is taking precedence on all other matters of Parliament. So I think we should look at that so that we also demonstrate to the Constitutional Court that we are serious about ensuring that it's not just put on the back burner and it is for some other day. So I think it is important that there is not even a program committee and not even the speaker needs to decide that. It is automatic. Once it is tabled, it is within the period, it complies with the rules, it just simply passes all sorts of hurdles to be scheduled and it takes precedence on the business of the house. Then, just to try and annotate this little bit, I do believe that because we confirm that it is not an issue that is just refer now specifically to the draft proposal put on the table by the inner table. That's just, it is a matter for the speaker and the chief whip of the majority party to decide. So, I do believe that we should say there should be a minimum time back, and it will be no less than a 90-minute debate or a 120-minute debate. So that also, as far as that's concerned, we give credibility to the fact that we take this matter as a very serious debate in the Parliament, and that we cannot just be 50-minute debating all over the journalists and talk. So, say, with that, as far as the composition of the program is concerned, I think we will have to probably move towards a committee that could function and not be disturbed when consensus is not reached. I would like to, I am concerned, can I say, if we go for the bigger committee, we may have a quorum problem, as we have found out in the past. So that is just as far as I'm concerned, but yes, I think we will have to reconsider the functioning as well as
in September.
Thank you, Chair. I will not touch it. May I ask the following? And I think I want to ask it in the spirit in which the discussions are going at the moment. Let me first of all thank Marina and the rest of the people that put together this document. May I ask a question to them firstly? In the proposals that they are putting that they have put before us, have they explored sufficiently internally any mechanisms that could be used to deal with the situation? Let me make an example. Although it's not on the base and it's on the bill, but the spirit of the example I want to talk about, there's in the rules it makes provision for a deadlock mechanism when it comes to a bill between the houses. Has that avenue not been explored in the proposals that have been put here? Notwithstanding the fact that it's a bill, but I think it's sort of the intention that the rule is giving us here. So if that one can be clarified. And then the second one that I want to ask you, I think the proposal was made by Honourable Amdusini, and then I think the Honourable Kilian also said something about it. I want to understand the rationale of saying that we need to have it twice a year. I'm not saying your proposal for both. I want to understand that rationale. Firstly, the practicality of it. If we look at the program of Parliament vis-a-vis the amount of sittings and so on, can we, and they give practical expression to how that has been taken into consideration. If you say every 6 months, we sort of operate on the basis of 4 quarters. And whatever we decide, we decide within the quarters most of the time, as opposed to the actual month. What would that mean within the quarter system that we have when they talk about every 6 months? But I also would want to understand, why would you create an event, sort of a six-month event, as you say? Why is it not driven by the determining factors at a point in time, as opposed to, because your point of departure is that we mustn't make Parliament silly and frivolous and all of this, but now you're saying already, look, let's go into the 6 months in privilege thing already. So if you really can clarify to me those things that I put in there. Then, Chair, I want to ask, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have, the reason why we are here is that we have been asked by the court to provide progress and so on. I want to table the question here to say to ask everyone, how do we see ourselves, apart from what some of the proposals on the table, how do we see ourselves taking the responsibility on progress that are being made, and what shall that progress be? I think that we've got to place that matter on the table, because that will assist our deliberation here also, and what it is that we want to achieve out of this and probably other meetings that we're going to have. Is it expected of you as the chairman of progress, or are we taking joint responsibility of progress that needs to be made? Thank you.
I'm going to first check, is there any member that has not had their first bite, and then I'll go into the second bite. Killian. Kalian.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think for me, we would need to just look, because it is a proposal to relook at the constitution of the programming committee. But I think we need to look at what is the role and function of the programming committee. Because if I heard Honorable Jeffries correctly, he says that the ANC decides what the program is, and either by consensus or not. Now, my understanding is that it is a consultative body, that we try and reach consensus, but it's not an ANC decision-making committee. So I think we need to decide really what is the role and function of the programming committee, because my understanding is that we must do what is right. We must debate and discuss or schedule stuff that is right for the country, not what is right for the ANC. And just because the ANC has a majority does not mean that they have a right to decide. So for me, I think the definition of the right needs to be much clearer, and Honorable Jeffrey himself raised that, you know, is it an unfettered right or fettered right? But I think that we have to relook at the role and function of the programming committee. In one of the recommendations, Marina, now you're saying that the speaker has the right or will be given the right to decide or schedule the debate. But rule, I think 190E says the leader of government business. I think it is in consultation with or just on his or his or her own.
I'm sure there's a context to what Honorable JJ was saying. I recall my days of being a whip, a house whip, that we had this structure called programming technical, where senior ANC looked at what is being brought by government to parliament, and what else is brought for consideration by parliament other than government business, and put all of that before program. So it has that inherent responsibility to lead the process of setting the program of parliament. I think without attempting to represent him or in any way, or even for that matter, misrepresent what he's putting across. But generally what I've understood to prevail, so much so that when I chaired the committee on the task team on legal attendance, I recall the opposition party vehemently objected to the notion that they could be obligated, for example, to contribute to a quorum, that they have the inherent right to actually frustrate the quorum of Parliament, if it means that would frustrate the intentions of government to procure or to prosecute government. So clearly the responsibility of seeing to it that Parliament executes its responsibility of passing legislation, etc., weighs more heavily on the side of the majority party, as the governing party of the day, than it does on the opposition. So I think that that is a context to some of these issues which is applicable to all democracies, that we can debate these issues. All right. There's nobody else who has skipped on the first round. Oh, Honorable Sultan. Yeah, then I'll start with CJJ again.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the joint that we are dealing with the Westminster system in our parliament, and sometimes we have to look back and try to correct that. The issue of the votes of no confidence being debated, I think there should be real matters or issues for that kind of debate to be brought to the fore without having it to be discussed to me every time. Of course, it has become really difficult. There should be real aggravating circumstances that would lead to that, not just for the sake of having. I think we need to have a rethink of the 6 month issue. You should not want to, I would like to reduce Parliament to that level of 6 months. We need to really, all of us, bring up a very sound 6 months or a necessity for that. I think the member of the COP came very close to that, to say, let's have real substantive matter for that, not just visualize it for this one. And the second issue, Chairperson, for me would be on the matter of, well, the time allocation. I would have thought that the rules do cover us quite substantively and also through a consultation process. All parties involved without being dictated on that matter. I would like to tackle with that one. Where I think we are the ones to also reason seriously on the programming committee in its constitution. I think we go back to our parties to discuss this matter, especially when one member was raising the question of the way the Parliament is constituted in terms of its number. I think if that one goes also to the programming committee for various reasons, though I know also that the committee normally operates on a consensus approach, but when it comes to voting, surely that kind of a rule will have to be applied in as far as proportional representation, yes. So I think we'll have to deal with that. It's a grey area, of which, but I think the table staff has made a proposal, of which we'll have also to think a little bit deeper on it, so that nobody finds himself or herself disadvantaged in the manner of the constituting of that committee. I think those are the two issues that I want to raise. Thank you.
Is there anybody who hasn't had their first bite yet who I may have overlooked? None. Okay, JJ, you raised your hand first.
Yeah, just maybe,
can we just say that in this second round, let's also attempt to respond to the issues that have been raised in the first round, and also get to clarify whether are we getting to a point where there are many divergent views, or there is a central thematic view, if you like, but with different nuances along the way, so that we clarify where the differences could be, but also where the points of potential consensus could be, bearing in mind that we have agreed from the start that this is not a decision forum at this stage, it's a consultative forum to assist us when we go back to our principles to have a much more effective mandate when we go back to the principles.
Yes, I mean, I think what we should be aiming for is options. So for the staff to try and crystallize what is being said into various options that will make it easier. So we try and have one proposal at this point. Just having said that, starting with the programming committee, I mean, Dr. Ambassini used the example of the convention. And the convention was that it was a consultative body, and it worked, I think, fine. The opposition generally accepted that the majority party set the agenda, and the majority party listened to the opposition. But it then came into a problem where there's a problem where the opposition feel the majority party is not listening to them, and in fact, as Dr. Ambassini says, the rule provides for voting, and the majority does not have a majority on that committee, so you could have, I think, the unheard of situation where the majority party does not determine the program of the legislature, and that's the difficulty to deal with. If you go the option of the table is proposing, you've got the problem, and I hear what Dr. Ambrosini says, well, then where there's dispute there can be voting. But you've got the problem at every meeting, even if decisions are taken by consensus, there has to be a quorum. And I suspect that would be a problem the bigger you are. If you go for 30-something committee, at that weekly programming committee, there would have to be a quorum of 18 people. And that may be difficult, particularly when sometimes the programming committee, during recess to look at the program, and you only, in fact, need the main role players. And that's why I'm raising the point that should it not be rather a consultative, and I'm throwing it out, it's something to look at. It's a consultative body where parties can be consulted. You want to be as inclusive as possible. You want to include even small parties that feel they have something to say. So I think Freedom Front has got 3 members. Their attendance at those programming committee meetings is really, really good. Other parties have a lesser attendance. UDM has more members. I don't want to sort of start naming parties, but UDM has more members in the Freedom Front, but they hardly ever attend. Their attendance is less than at the Freedom Front. So I think it's correct that you have the right, you have the opportunity to attend, you have the opportunity to make an input. So that's why I'm raising the question of effectively, it was a consultative forum. Should it not remain as a consultative forum rather than a deciding forum?
That's a good question. Who would be the decision maker if it's consultative?
Well,
I'm
getting to that. You see, the rules at the moment are that the chief whip signs the order paper as per the decision of the decision of the programming committee. So what I'm raising, throwing out is that the chief whip signs the order paper after considering the input of the programming committee, or something like that. But to keep it as, you basically want 2 things. You want the majority party to have the right, which is, I think, well, which happens in every legislature, to determine the program. But you want to have a forum where other role players, other parties are listened to. Let's look at the Western Cape. I know that the ANC gets often very unhappy with the DA and the program. But again, I think it's the DA effectively determines the program. You know, the easier thing with the provincial legislatures is that you have fewer parties, so it's easier to determine a majority because of our proportional representation system. But I think it's a question of the questions I'm raising. As far as the program, because it's what has grown up, the convention was working fine, but then when the convention fell apart, we've then got problems. Does the majority party have the right, by virtue of its majority, to determine the agenda after considering the inputs of other parties? And if the opposition can sort of look at that, because my fear of the opposition in terms of accepting that the ANC could have a majority or should have a majority on the programming committee seems to be accepting that. But so once you start giving the ANC a majority, you then have the problems of quorum. That it's not just going to be a case of where there's a big dispute.
But it's your quorum, so
it's applying to me too. You know, that's basically the issue on the programming. Then I think the other difficulty we've got is okay. Basically, I'm saying everybody accepts that the ANC should have a majority on the programming committee. But the problem is, once you start doing that, you're going to run into the quorum problem. And you might want to have a programming committee meeting of 9 people. If the speaker, if the DA, if the IC are usually there, the ANC obviously are there, that there can be a discussion on the program. It shouldn't be paralyzed by the fact that there aren't 18 people present to take a decision. Because committees can only take decisions if they're quorate. Otherwise, they're not decisions. I think that's obvious. I don't know why Marina's looking. Okay.
I was wondering how different from the committee
is. Well, maybe we're not, because we weren't practicing in terms of convention. But once you start checking, yeah. So anyway, basically, can I move off the programming committee issue? But so I am floating the idea of should it not be a consultative body, which the majority party must listen to. Then I think that the presiding officer, the speaker, because majorities often, if you look at Western Cape, if you look at KZN with the IFP, can be less flexible in their time. You know, the speaker does play an important role in protecting the rights of the minority and therefore some kind of override responsibility for the speaker generally as far as debate and motions may be useful. That's what's already there with matters of public importance and urgent public importance. The speaker determines when those are going to be, and the speaker has a discretion on that. As far as then, we've got then the problem, and I mean, Judge Davis does make particular reference to the fact that the Constitutional Court may not agree with him, but we do have the issue of, is this right to have a motion of no confidence debated unfettered? I think from all the parties here, basically, it has been an acceptance that it shouldn't be unfettered. You should be able to provide restrictions in terms of timing, in terms of numbers. But that's not necessarily what Judge Davis said, but maybe he didn't apply his mind to the matter adequately. But I'm just saying those are things to look at. I think they're useful. Obviously, the different circumstances would determine different things. If you have a coalition government, you may want to have motions of no confidence more often. I think my difficulty with the proposal that it automatically takes precedence, well, it would link to the question of, is it unfettered? Do you put other restrictions on it? But even if it also depends on the responsibility of opposition parties. So if Mrs. Killian, if you say it takes precedence, you might have, the president has called the session of the National Assembly for something, and an opposition party wants to have a motion of no confidence, and if you follow your route, it automatically takes precedence over any other business, but it's then on the order paper. The Minister of Finance is tabling the budget, but because a small party wants to get maximum coverage, they want to have a motion of no confidence on that day, and it must take precedence before the Minister of Finance can table the budget. And the party will do it because it's when the nation is watching to watch the budget. Now they're going to watch instead a motion of no confidence in the debate. So there are those kinds of difficulties, but I think that needs to be looked at. But as I said, it links to the issue of, is it unfettered? And generally everybody seems to be, I think, saying it's not, there should be restrictions. You can't have frivolous ones unnecessarily too often, those kinds of things. But it's a question of how we deal with that. That's why the one of in a sense, a convention being a basic right, that it should be scheduled, if it's not scheduled, that you can appeal to the speaker. I don't think that the speaker has to schedule it if it's frivolous. If the speaker is not frivolous, then should be able to direct when it is set. Although there may be issues in terms of the speaker is somebody in line for the time of the dinner. The speaker is in line to become president if all other options fail as per the constitution. So that has its own complications. So I don't know if I'm really proposing solutions, but I'm just throwing out areas of difficulty.
And I
just sorry, last point on the secret ballot. Look, I mean, the constitution specifies the election of the president by secret ballot. It doesn't specify the removal of a motion of no confidence. I must say, Mr. Dr. Ambrosini, we would have loved a secret ballot motion of no confidence in KZN in the first 5 years, which the IFP vigorously opposed. But I think we need to stick with what the constitution specifies. And we are representing parties effectively.
I'll stay neutral and not enter the fray at chairperson when it comes to this. Colleagues, can I say that I take the point from Honourable Jeffrey that the ideal should be to put concrete alternatives that can be engaged with as we discuss our respective political parties. But I still feel that in the process we have narrowed down a lot of areas which otherwise may have been seen as divergent positions, which have effectively become common ground. And those, I think, is the point of departure, a building block in this exercise. I just wanted to say the following, and then I'll allow the next person. When I observe proceedings in the House, I see the Chief Whip literally performing an institutional function where he has to move motions of the nature that go to ensuring that Parliament attends its core business and decisions are taken and so on and so on. So that leadership function seems to be given, and I haven't come across a situation where anybody challenged that and said, why should it be the Chief Whip who has to do this stuff? And maybe that gives a clue as to our understanding of how the parliamentary democracy actually is expected to work. And in a sense, I'm responding to the question or reacting to the question who should set the program of Parliament. Up to now, the system has worked. The only time that there was a fallout was last year because of a particular set of circumstances. That was a unique situation, and I don't think anybody would disagree with that from empirical evidence. There has been motions of non-confidence. The majority party entertained it. You know, it happens. So there is no question about anybody feeling that there isn't such a responsibility to allow for a debate. I think it was more a question of the timing of it. Now, even the issue of progress, as everybody has said, it's never been an issue. And it's only been an issue because of that specific issue and nothing else. And now we're, as a result, going back to the drawing table. But if you look at generally how we've operated, the idea has been to allow within this for the business of Parliament to go ahead and not to try and further things or prevent things from being able to be debated. But obviously within think essentially what we are trying to achieve is to come with a reasonable structure within which we can allow for all the things that we do happen. And I think that should be the spirit. My fear is that if we're going to get into a mode of trying to, in a nitpicky way, a mechanistic, a mechanical way approach this thing, we might just in the process distort the nature and character of the institution as it always does. And I think that might just defeat the purpose. But let's see the responses from the other colleagues, second round. Okay, I'll start with you, Mr. Anderson, again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is something that we need to keep in mind as we hear these discussions, which is an important element of the equation, and that is political accountability. It is not all, as you say, Mr. Chairman, technicality. If one abuses the power, and does something still in parliament, it gets lambasted in front of the electorate. So we don't need to provide for irrational behavior by political parties, because that needs to be kept in check and balanced by means of the political accountability. The constitutional judgment is a right. We are discussing whether it should be absolute or not absolute, sacred and sacred, and the political accountability creates a check and balance. Obviously, we do not want a situation where the house is open with an opportunity for silent prayer of meditation and a vote of no confidence. So that's not what we have in mind. I agree that the best way of making progress is for the staff, assisted by the lawyer, to give a crisp option in terms of text. Option one, option two, option three. And then clean up things with the assistance of a lawyer, like affect by the things which have given effect to the Constitution, put it in proper legal language that wouldn't be seen. Now, on the programming committee, I accept what the Honorable Justice says, the practical difficulty of having a quorum. I have difficulty in ascribing the decision-making power to the chief whip. Mm-hmm. I accept what you say, Mr. Chairman, that the chief whip plays an institutional role or its output. But, you see, the Honorable Jeffrey and I have a great advantage. We have a perspective of things when they go wrong from his viewpoint or from my viewpoint. And if you were in Kostuna town, if I suggested that we made our chief whip the decision-making body, it would have gone berserk, and it would have never been accepted. So, and this is the type of shaping of institution that we need to have in mind. Power to an even can be abused, and there are no checks and balances. So that's very difficult. So how do you fix this? If it were to be given to the decision-making power to the chief whip, and I haven't thought this through, but immediate reaction, one would need at least the corrective mechanism that one-third of the members of the programming committee can challenge the decision and bring it for a decision by the House. Now, how is that any different if the ANC is the majority? The difference lies in the fact that if the conduct by the chief whip and the ANC is unreasonable, then the mechanism of political accountability comes into play. The opposition gets an opportunity of venting its spleen, getting overruled in the House, but then exposing politically what it deems to be an unreasonable and vexatory behavior. So that corrective, at least for me, would go a long way in creating a measure of comfort if the decisionaire, as Bush put the decision, visionary becomes the chief whip. Now, on the 6 months, the notion was not to hold a vote of no confidence every 6 months, but no more than every 6 months. I mean, the fact is that we could have moved a vote of no confidence at any time, and we never did it. It comes a time when political parties have political reasons to do it. It was not done during the time of Mbeki. So it is done when there is a political need. And it would be ill-advised not to have the need be satisfied, because all these are symbols. They let the steam up, and they have all the avoided explosion. You get a lot of no confidence, you win, we all go out happy. We have to say what we say, and it's done. That doesn't happen, the steam builds up.
But just to clarify that point, I understood those that were questioning the 6 month issue to be saying, what value would it add if in any case, unless you're saying that as a matter of course it has to happen.
No, I would say
but
no.
But if you're saying what you're saying now, if I understood you correctly, then what would be the value add out of even mentioning it? Because in any case, ultimately, the decider would be whether there is a compelling reason to actually.
We are looking at
sorry, just one last point.
I'm not sure if you're still coming to the other part of the question that I asked, and that is, how did you derive the 6 months?
No, I'm getting there. Well, 6 months, as I said, it's like the decider.
I'm allowing this interjection because remember, in this round, we want to clarify.
No, it's a fact out of thin air. It's like 16 years of age for a driving license, or 18, why not 17 or 19? It's all this arbitrary. But the fact that is that in the ordinary course of business, a political party doesn't want to be beaten up by having a vote of no confidence thrown against him every time, because at the end the majority party wins it. So that is the no more than after 6 months. It would not be necessary, well enough, for the possibility of a radical party, where you get a party which is radical and forces people to debate the same motion over and over, then I suggest that the notion of a 6 month substantive motion could apply. And yes, it is every 2-3 meters, but it's, you know, we go by 3 meters. Every 3 meters might be 2 owners. Was a compromise for you to decide. The last point, Mr. Chairman, which I didn't raise on my first round.
Let go, but I didn't quite understand you.
Okay. Now, the Honorable September said we go back quarter.
Let me tell you what it is that I didn't understand.
Look.
The point that I seem to have heard come from actually both Mr. September and Mr. Zucker is to say, if ultimately what should be a determining factor of whether a motion should be debated or not, whether there is rational and a genuine ground to have a motion, what value would putting a limit as to frequency add? Because that would in any case be overridden.
Because the compelling
reason will ultimately in all instances and for all intents and purposes always be the ultimate determinant whether the motion does take place or not. Anyway. So in other words, the 6 month thing just becomes a superfluous additional condition. And if you take that principle as the basis.
You see, you cannot take that principle as the basis because the principle is unconstitutional. You cannot say that you can have a vote on no confidence only when there are good reasons to have one. You can have a vote on no confidence when I want one. That's how the Constitution works. Because otherwise somebody...
So it's not on need basis, it's on
no,
demand basis.
Yeah, on demand basis. Because there is no way...
Not that I need it, but that I want it.
I want it. Because otherwise who is to determine the need? I could think that the president should be a vote of no confidence against the president because he's wearing ties which are poor at the time, and the president dressed like that shouldn't be the president. But I mean that's not a ground that other people may feel. So that's not in terms of the Constitution or the Davis judgment, the general understanding. It's a political matter, so it's in the eyes of the beholder. That's what you don't want. You don't want somebody to stand up and say, I want a vote of no confidence in the president because I don't like the way he dresses up. And that's the difficulty we are striving. So we are creating artificial lines. The last point, which I haven't raised in my first...
You might have difficulty with your own conscience if that were to be your motivation, because I think the president is always the chief when it comes to dress.
The problem is the chairman is
the
conscience is rarely checked on appointment, and it doesn't seem to be a requirement of office. But the last point that I didn't raise, what the judgment tells you that you have the right to a debate and a vote on the motion of no confidence. We have not had our right has been taken away. The last time around, we did not have a vote on a motion of no confidence. There was one motion on the table which said we have no confidence in the president. Then the motion was changed. A complete different motion was put before us, which we had not seen. And we had a vote on a motion of confidence. I've written to the speaker, I've written to you, and I threatened litigation that is unconstitutional and in violation of the rule. Rule 96, and the speaker has made this beautiful statement, is let's solve things amongst ourselves, let's not go to litigation. So here you have an opportunity. Rule 96 says no amendment to draft resolution. So you cannot take out the word no and turn a draft resolution upside down and make a vote of no confidence into a vote of confidence. Now, there are three categories where it's permissible. The rule is no amendment. That's the rule. Then there are three exceptions. The except must be narrow. One, to draft a resolution on a question of privilege. Doesn't apply. To substitute the name of another member for the name of a member in the draft resolution. Peter is not there, John is not there. Then, which is allowed by the presiding officer. The third discretionary power of the presiding officer must be read within the fact that it is an exception from the principle and must be within the same parameters of A and B to correct problems and cannot detract from our right of having a vote of no confidence. So it cannot be utilized to transform a vote of no confidence into a vote of confidence.
Yeah.
So because it has been done, I have suggested in my amendment, which can
let me accept that we're not dealing with a historical.
No, but I have
going forward.
In the amendments I put forward, because it was done, it was interpreted way, I suggested some language which clarifies that it should not be done. And that's part of my amendment. Thank you.
Okay. We'll first, did they say age before beauty? I think beauty before age. Miss Killian. Somebody's going to kill me. all undiplomatic comments withdrawn. Unconditionally.
No offense.
So this is first of all, I think we also have to just listen out with my mind on the comments made by Honourable King to say what we're essentially doing is we're just establishing within our very young democracy the line of rules that would make for this debate accountability, all of those issues. Entrenched in our institution. And I think in the Constitution, Section 57.2, that's it, 57.1b, very clear. It says the National Assembly may make rules and orders concerning its business with due regard to representative and participatory democracy, the two, accountability, transparency, and public involvement. So I think that's where we come from. That is, we want to have accountability of and president in this that is the intention. And the intention is not to create silly notions of no conflict. The intention is to create debate about the performance of government, which is given to the president, which is the thing. So I think that is good. Secondly, I would like to support the notion that...
Yes, can I ask her to hold that? Because I can hear she came to another point, I just wanted to ask her to put clarity on the motivation that the member has given. My question is, are you saying that the motivation that you're giving out of the Constitution, are you saying that there isn't sufficient mechanism in this Parliament to do what those clauses are saying, and hence that motivates us? That's where I'm not with you.
Yes. What I'm saying is our rules should be developed within the context to make sure that happens, and I argue that we don't have that, and obviously the court, we have had court processes that we don't have, so that's why the ruling is there. So, now, that is just to say that we're building an institution and we're building rules for debate, and when the ANC is no longer the ruling party, they must, within the rules, find the same expression, the opportunity to express their dissatisfaction with whoever is the new government. So I think we must just understand that. It's not for expediency that we're insisting on participants for this changes in this regard. Secondly, I just want to say what I find interesting is in our rules, the fact that we have matters of public urgency, discussion of matters of public importance. And in this section, that's chapter 8 of our rules, it is clearly a matter for the speaker to discuss. Now, we will have to just see how we, we've been talking about the scheduling of a debate by the chief whip. Here, it is the speaker who decides on that issue. And I would like to argue that we will have to also take that into consideration. Because it's clear here, 104, I see Marina is frowning at me, 104 sub-3, if the speaker grants the request, the presiding officer shall announce it in this house, and debate on the matter shall stand over until the time appointed by the presiding officer. So, such a discussion shall not exceed the time allocated by calling by the speaker of the consultation with the leader of the house. So I'm just saying that we will also just have to look at that, because I would like to argue that the motion of no confidence is a very important matter, and we will have to align whatever we say about that also as part of that is concerned. Because we are now debating the role of the chief whip. The Honourable Chairperson has said to us he's actually having an institutional role. Honourable Jeffrey said he is consulting the program committee. But there is a different chapter where there is a definite promise given to the speaker. And I think from the draft that Marina said, it's clear that there is an intention that we should consider that it's about the office of the speaker. And that we should look at that. So, Chair, in conclusion, just to say the issue of the 6 months, there was certainly a misunderstanding. We have indicated that not more than that, because there is already a precedent in some of the counties that there is except that we should allow, but if we are not found to be unconstitutional, unless it's urgent. Is attested here that there has been a threshold of members who actually support this exception to what is usually being allowed in the House. And I don't want to make sure, I think we need to make sure that we are not infringing anyone. By doing that, we will open the possibility. Thank you.
Because it was quite useful before the other.
just basically the format, I mean, and de facto is what is there already, is the chief whip determines the program, because the chief whip can put, the chief whip puts things on the program that have not necessarily been to the programming committee, draft resolution. Usually the parties will be informed that there's this draft resolution going on the order paper saying you don't set up enough opportunities. So I think parties are usually always informed, but those are not necessarily things agreed by the programming committee. So I think the issue is that the chief was determining the program, but the speaker having the power to instruct on certain matters, particularly where it comes to protecting the rights of opposition parties. The speaker has the power, as Mrs. Killian has raised, to instruct those matters to be put on.
And
it's
not a
voting.
Yes. All right. Let's talk to politicians. Let's get some gas for the technocrat pitch. Yes.
Thank you, sir. No, I just wanted to explain the current role that is played by the chief whip in terms of Rule 22. It says the chief whip must arrange the business of the assembly on the order of PIFA, subject to these rules, the directives of the program committee, and the concurrence of the leader of government business. So currently, the program committee decides the program, and what the chief whip does is to arrange. In other words, what should be item one, what should be item two. And of course, there's also the addition of motions here and there. The other point I wanted to make is also the issue of whether when you have the composition of the committee changed to enable the majority party to have a majority, you would then always need to have a quorum before the meeting can proceed with the proceedings. Rule 25 allows or enables the House to proceed with its business without a quorum. And you can have a rule similar to that, which will then say the NAPC can proceed with its business without a quorum, and you only need a quorum when they're going to be voting. Because currently, Rule 25 says you will need a quorum before there's a decision on a matter or a vote. But in the NAPC, you could then say only when you need to vote on the matter, then you would need a quorum. Otherwise, the NAPC should not be frustrated by the absence.
There, which I'd like you to also address, would be that essentially programming committee meets purely for the purposes of making decisions. In other words, what is going to go into the program? It usually does not fit just to have a general engagement.
On that point, I think what Mr. Park was saying is you don't need a quorum to take a decision. You only need a quorum to vote. And I think that is quite dicey, seriously. I think it is, because the whole purpose of the quorum is protection to ensure that you've got the numbers before decisions are taken. Whether those decisions are taken unanimously or by a vote, it doesn't matter. So I'm worried with that point of... And that is why the constitute, the House and committees can sit. The House can sit and deal with business, but when it comes to taking a decision, whether that decision is by consensus or voting is irrelevant.
Yeah.
You need a quorum.
Yeah.
And I think that proposal I don't think would fly constitutionally.
Yeah.
I think it's dicey.
Because you either say that quorum does not make a decision,
yes.
In which case this issue is not right.
Yeah.
But if this forum is to take decisions, then the principles of proportional representation applies in the Constitution. Whether the rules provide for them or not is not the issue, but I think the constitutional principle is clear. Decisions have to be taken in the spirit of that principle in the constitution, in whatever institution we create in the institution. So I don't know if you agree with that. Yeah, sure. So I think it's...
Does
clear,
that mean that what we've been doing up to now is certainly under...
No. You're missing a point which is fundamental, and that point is that generally the manner in which the programming committee has operated.
Yeah, my understanding is that the program committee has up to now operated on an agreement basis. Because you
on a consensual basis, yeah.
Yeah, well, agreement, consensus. The idea of voting is, in all the time that I've been there has never come up. It is only now when we got to this no confidence debate when there was a problem. Now, you must never legislate for exceptions. So we must try and find an acceptable way of making it
Honorable
work.
J.J. earlier alluded to the role of the chief who is defining the audit.
No.
Let me just clarify the point. He was, if I understood him correctly, trying to explain that regardless of what the programming committee would do, the final giving effect to that would rest with the chief by way of that the audit paper. He was explaining the status quo. You may agree or disagree what that yes, no, I
agree.
No, I'm not saying that's what was agreed. I'm just clarifying what he okay, let's call it his
the chief was, I mean, that rule is subject to the direction of the programming committee. The chief was signed the order paper. Things get put on the order paper which often have not been to programming, like draft resolutions printed on the order paper. Procedural issues. Usually, I think, if not in all cases, the other parties or the main parties are informed and can object, and if there's an objection, presumably something would be done. But I'm just saying, de facto, it's not my interpretation, de facto, the chief whip is determining the agenda by signing the order paper, not necessarily subject,
No, but that's not what our rules say. Our rules say he arranges the program. It doesn't say he determines the program. That's why there is a programming committee. And if we give this carte blanche right to the chief whip,
as far as I recall, the chief whip signature determines whether an item goes above or stays below the line. But it will be on the order paper. Is that not correct?
Well, it's a question of what is determining and what is arranging.
Let me stop interjecting and misleading in the process. You go ahead, but finish the point.
The point really is that we've made a lot of noise about frivolous. It shouldn't be frivolous. Now, the really same chief, when we presented our motion of no confidence, his first words were, it's frivolous. Don't look at the record. That's what he said. Now, how can you allow one person to decide whether the thing is frivolous or not? The programming committee must continue with its work. If necessary, we must redetermine the numbers. The smaller configuration, I would think, is the better one. So it's easier to have a forum if we really do need a forum at all times. But I think the way we've operated up to now is a sensible one, where obviously the program is a committee of technicians that try and put together a program. It's taken to the programming committee, and there it is debated. You will remember the one instance where our request for the wage subsidy debate was not agreed to by a committee of the technocrats or the ANC until we got to the programming committee, and when I then insisted and referring to the rules and the constitution, it was then decided, or somebody in that committee said, all right, we'll consider it. I said, no. Who's we? We is the programming committee. We must determine it now. And we did. Now, if we can write the rules in such a way that we carry on with the status quo we've got now, but in cases of severe difference, we can likely be in the house, ring the bell, and get the members to come in for the vote. Why do we need to have a quorum present all the time? While the debating goes on,
we left this discussion over 20 minutes.
That thing goes off 3 times in a week. Mine hasn't gone off.
No.
So you are now being biased.
interjected you unintentionally.
Okay.
I thought you had been, sorry. That's why I allowed it.
And I also want to say that what we're discussing in personal music, obviously, like you said at the very start of the movement, our caucuses must decide and then come back with a view of the caucuses. So we're really just some of these items referring to how we feel about it, comment. And if that is so, I would like to re-emphasize my point that I don't think we must put any restriction on when a motion of no confidence can be given. The Constitution says the member has the right. We've never had that problem before. I'm telling you, the moment you put limitations, it's going to become a race on who's going to be first to put in a motion of no confidence. Leave it as it is, but just determine. I like the idea of that within 7 days the decision must be taken so that the debate can go on.
Yeah, I wish I understood what you meant by no limitation.
The point of having only one motion of no confidence every 6 months or every 3 months, those are the limitations on what the Constitution
Okay, that's what I understand. What else are you referring to?
Yeah,
that's the issue. Thanks for your question. You wanted to quickly interject, and then we'll come back to you, Ms. Dunbergen. I won't say you should be fired or things anymore.
I'm going to reply anyway. I just wanted to say about the issue of a frivolous motion. What Sandra King was referring to, the issue of the president not wearing her eye, kind of thing about that. That is where the speaker's power comes into a main motion, that is things that are not in keeping with practice and with the rules. I mean, obviously, if it's a frivolous motion, the speaker can rule it out of order in the something like that.
The way I understood him to be saying is that if his motivation is because he doesn't like the president's time, it's not necessarily stated literally in the motion, it's stated in his head. It's what motivates him to want to put such a motion, and he's saying it should not be about how he motivates it. It should be about whether he has requested it, and that should be. And unless I misunderstood, I thought Mr. Andresini was saying that. Because the issue is that we really want to make sure that we don't misunderstand each other. So let's clarify this. Yes, Ms. Anderson. Well, Ms. Kelly and I'll come back to you. Let's just get him to clarify himself.
Okay. Let me clarify myself with the words of Justice Van Zyl during the private member's deal case, in which the lawyer representing the speaker made exactly the same argument. And Van Zyl says, well, what about frivolous appeals? And we can't have a frivolous private member appeal. And Van Zyl said, well, if I've been elected as a member of parliament into the animal rights party, why can I not introduce a appeal on animal rights? It would be for the majority of the people to say we don't care about animal rights. And that was the view of the Constitutional Court when it talked about democracy not being a number formula only, but to allow for any input, and then the number comes on the decision, not on the input. So if one were to be, by the same token, were to be elected on the fashionable party, and they believe that people should dress properly, and he wants to have a vote of no confidence in the president because they feel that they've not been, the president doesn't dress properly, who are we to say that that's frivolous? I am vehemently opposed to the power of the speaker or anyone else to determine what is frivolous, what is not frivolous, what is right, what is not right. I keep referring to the old private member bill of Art Whitman, who was trying to ban smoking in public places, who was deemed to be absolutely frivolous. And then there is another reason. The speaker is not a decision maker. The more power we give to the speaker in terms of policy making and decision making, the more we undermine in this institutional position throughout all parliament. The dignity of the speaker, of the president, of the presiding officer, is assured by making sure that no decision can be ascribed to him, but they must be ascribed to a committee, or if not to the House itself.
Possibly the power of the speaker to amend a motion, and as the rule said, clarity.
Powers under the speaker under 103 and 104.
Yes.
I'm
so you're basically against what is in fact the status quo.
I'm not clear with Dr. Ambrosini's because on the one hand he agrees with restrictions in terms of and this is just your proposal, you know, once every 6 months, a restriction of a third for more than that. Now he's saying no restrictions.
No, I'm sorry if I may. On the frivolous aspect, not restrictions on the merit. As per the frequency. Now, content, we can't catch content. As per the frequency, you know, the nice thing of being in a room like this is that we must listen to one another, hear one another. And I was hearing what the Honorable Watson was saying. And what he effectively said is, you know, it worked fine for 18 years. And there have been some very rough 18 years. Now, it broke down on this occasion. So do we really need that? I mean, something that worked for 18 years, and we had now a better understanding, if his proposal, if I understand it correctly, is don't change the programming committee, just let's make sure that we have deadlines for the vote on no confidence, and let's fix the provision of the vote on no confidence, and let's keep going on with the system as it is, because all considered it worked well, and the problems that ended up there is because there were no provisions on the vote on no confidence. If we fix the vote on no confidence, it may work well for the next 13 years, if I understood it correctly.
I had Ms. Callion wanting another bite, that's correct.
The point is like so old now, but anyway, I want to know, just to get back to the programming committee, what is the function of the so-called technical committee, and why isn't the opposition party represented on the technical program?
Another one of those that have been like that time immemorial, and it worked well. But okay, Mr. Gum wants to.
Yeah, just quickly, I think that if we are now, because as I hear the both the IFP and the DA now, is that you are taking. That obviously you still have to clear with your parties, but that we are actually, we need to have a sort of an unfettered right there to have a motion of no confidence debated. I just think that maybe, if that is your position, it's actually moving away from maybe a consensual position that we would be able to find. And I think that maybe that the Honourable Ambrosini's initial position has actually been that it is not, it should not be dealt with, that kind of a right to prevent frivolous motions and so on. I don't know whether it's going to help if we move to a position where you are basically saying from your side that it has to be dealt with as a completely unfettered right without any threshold provision or anything like that. On the other point, I do think that the Honourable Ambrosini, that he does have a point in saying that if we are going to allow the speaker, whoever, to rule on these kind of motions on the basis of its merits and such, with its privileges and all that kind of thing, then we might, I tend to agree with him that then we might move to with dangerous territory in terms of whether we are not indeed limiting this right too far to great extent.
Any further contributions? Are there any ideas that still need to be crystallized? Clearly, in the search of Honorable JJ suggestion, the idea is to have as many useful options to be put forward, ideally crystallized enough so that we all have a clear sense of what those ideas really are and are not, for that matter, so that we're able to put very concrete and clear crispy and crystallized ideas before all our parties for decision. Few, concise, rather than have too many, some of which might not necessarily be carefully thought through and crafted and so on. So have we reached that point where we can say we have confidently put the various options in a crisp way forward for the purposes of formulation? Yes, Ms. Kelly?
We have all the legal rules.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask that they look at this issue as the unsettled.
Yeah.
And I would like to suggest that we consult the ruling on private litigation. And the reason is that several paragraphs were quoted by Judge Day. But he is referring to barriers that are being imposed. Now, certainly, one would have to consider that if there is a feeling amongst members here that it is a right to propose a motion of no confidence, just as it is a right to present a private member's draft proposal. You know, so I just wanted to make sure that we go through that and identify a possible problem that would limit the ability of the National Assembly to impose that. That's all I want.
I don't know if there's anybody who wants to comment on this issue as we're sitting here now.
Isn't it so that throughout the law, constitution, whatever, there are limitations? All citizens in the country can't just,
It's not so much the question whether or not there is a limitation. I think that's a given. Life itself is limited. You can't live beyond a certain age, I suspect. But unless with all the cloning and things. But that is it. I mean, this room is limited by the contour of the wall, and you can't go beyond the wall. Otherwise, anyway. But look, it's more the nature of the limitation and whether it would, in the context of that right, be found to be effectively denying the right or not. I just wanted to say, I don't know if there are comments on this issue around the Ambrosini versus, sorry, the private members' decision versus the issue at hand that anybody wanted to express here and now, a comment on very briefly. Otherwise, unless somebody else feels that there is an issue that has not been properly combated, they're liberty to do so, because I'm moving towards a point where I am beginning to feel that we have exhausted our perspectives on this issue and that the issues are fairly clear to what the different positions are, such that the table staff should be in a position to formulate the options in the spirit of Honorable JJ's suggestion. Anybody who still has some doubt on some or other issue? Yes, my vision is not very strong, so please feel free.
As I said, quick comment.
Yes.
Because the rule, the section in the Constitution doesn't really say that it's subject to the rules or other legislation, etc. We ask, if you look at the right of freedom of speech, that's where that is subject to obviously the application of legislation. That is not the case as far as the notion of confidence of terms. Maybe that should be considered as well, that if you start imposing legislation, what is the same, how does it change?
It's about section, is it section 57 or 58 that says that Parliament determines its own business through its own rules? Doesn't that effectively become a form of limitation? And right now we're just talking about 90 minutes or 120 minutes debate. That already could be seen as a limitation. Some feel, let us debate until forever.
So, I mean, on that point, I mean, my understanding of the Davis judgment was that there was a right, but he was not going to, it was up to Parliament to determine when. So the request from the opposition to say it must take place before the end of the year, he wasn't prepared to entertain. So that in itself is a limitation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's clear from everybody generally. I mean, I know Dr. Ambassini raises the point of the electorate, but you cannot have a situation where you have motions of no confidence on a weekly basis. I think everybody is accepting that. So I think, and then the other issue with Judge Davis is he did make it quite sort of clear it would be the Constitutional Court. I mean, he was asked.
Do you agree, Mr. Watson, to the comment he just made?
But then the other issue with Judge Davis. The other issue with Judge Davis, I mean, something that he mentioned, I mean, he got asked at very short notice to make a decision. But his judgment was quite clear to be for the Constitutional Court to determine whether he's right or not.
Any last words from anybody? Yes, Marina?
I just want to also ask some of my thoughts. Do you want to?
Let me just clarify. There might be an idea which is a common understanding, but as you unpack the idea, there might be different options. That's what I call nuances. But there may be totally different ideas from beginning to start. In that event, obviously, the whole approach is to set out that idea separate from another idea, etc. But I think the best way that you are able to interpret what was said and able to structure it, put it together, it will be circulated to colleagues, and if anybody feels that an idea has not been properly or adequately articulated, it's up to them to revert back to you as a matter of fact. I think that's it. But I interjected you, and that's practical.
At the moment, we haven't addressed that because we did not see that the Jordan and the other thing to this one. And then Mr. Jesse said no, there was content issue. So at that meeting, then I'll start really putting something about speaker silence.
They have put it on the table. And they have given their reason. And I think Mr. Jeffrey has indicated that the Constitution does not require a secret ballot when it comes to 89 or 102, but that it only expressly provides for a secret ballot when it comes to the actual election of a president. The principle in the law of interpretation that the express mention of the one thing is the implied exclusion of the other. But that is the opinion. That is the opinion for the two options. But the question has been put on the table and it cannot not be stated in the document.
It was the one point on we got the documentation for this meeting quite late. Ms. Quimino says it's because she has a lot of other things to do. Can Mr. Castle, as her, I think she's under you, ensure that she has enough time to well, anyway, can he ensure that assist the powers that be, at least if it's not him, that she has enough time to attend to this matter because it is urgent?
Although if you're holding her boss account, make sure that she...
We are attending that.
All right.
Now, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All that I personally would like to raise, it would do with any deal, draft of options for draft and agents. No explanation, it's 1 hour of work, no deal. So option one, option two, option three. And then we circulate this, and if you've got comments, any of us can redraft those options. We send the redraft in, and that gets circulated again.
I still feel that if there's a need to put a short note to explain the context in which a particular formulation is made, that might just assist an understanding of why that particular formulation is made that way. Otherwise, we could all completely go on a tangent and disagree on things because we didn't understand the context. Maybe you should do that as well, yeah. Yeah, not party, but the individual member. Yeah, I'm sure that's what you meant. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I think we've made headway, and we'll see you at the meeting. Are we going to be able to meet before the rules come in? So maybe we can use that day. Well, we'll deal with the issue of a day that ministers.
Now, we'll see you.
Okay, we'll deal with the issues administratively. Okay.